Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Toby Mathis. I'm coming Jeff. At you from, and there's Jeff.
Hey.
I was going to give the summation that we're not sitting in the same room for a change. Usually we're sitting eyeball to eyeball, but today I'm over in Cleveland, Ohio, and Jeff is back in
Summerlin.
Yeah. Oh, you're in Summerlin?
I'm in Summerlin, so neither one of us are in our usual spots.
Oh, wow. So you went over there to hang out with the tech guys. I know what's going on. Yeah. But we're going to jump on in. We have a lot to go over, and of course, we try to shoot for an hour, but I can't remember the last time we actually did an hour. Jeff, I think it was probably some other decade than now.
Yeah, I got nothing.
You got nothing. But if you have specific questions, you can always ask them at any time at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. What we do is we weed through the really convoluted long questions. We try to get to make sure you're a platinum client, get you an answer there. If they're shorter questions, then we grab them and make them part of the show. So that's how we grab those. We always get like hundreds of questions, and we always try to grab the ones that are the most relevant or that are succinctly asked. And if they're not specific to you, that's even better. Meaning that you didn't share a bunch of personal information, because we don't want to disclose your personal information during a webinar. All right. So it's fun, fast, and educational. We try to share not just answers, but give you the psychology behind it all. In other words, I don't want you just getting some sort of, all right, yes or no. I want you to really understand why the laws are written the way they're written, so that you can get to your own answers much easier. And also, the whole idea is to save money. At the end of the day, that's what we really want, is that you're better off. You're a better steward of your money than the government. And so if you can keep a hold on of it for as long as possible, that's usually in the best. All right. Other fun stuff to go over. Oh, you can always go to our Facebook page or our YouTube channel. And if you go to our YouTube channel, there's a little icon right next to where you subscribe. And if you click on that little icon, it will give you automatic updates. So when a new video comes out, like if there's a new tax law, if the regs come out like they did on 199 or on the qualified opportunity zones, and we put out videos, you'll just be notified next time you log into YouTube that there's new content. It doesn't hit you at home. It doesn't hit you on your texting or anything like that. It just says, hey, you have new videos. Not a bad idea, given that we have, you know, significant law changes, probably most significant in the last 30 years that were passed under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And they're still weeding through it, trying to make sense of it. Questions we're going to be going over tonight, and there are a ton of them. So just going to kind of start off. What are the advantages and differences between the C Corp, S Corporation, and LLC? And how do you know which one's best for you? We'll go over that. Our taxes filed quarterly for a C corporation. We'll go over that. Can I pay family members who are employed by my corporation annually with the amount paid depending on revenue? Or do I have to pay them at regular intervals throughout the year? We'll give you the rules on that, and that's a little convoluted. So are there ways to handle the sale of a personal residence that has significant appreciation in order to reduce capital gains or the gains tax on gains that exceed $500,000? They said married exemption, but it's the capital gains exclusion, I believe they're talking about. We formed a corporation in 2014, That's funny. We only started taking reimbursements within the last year. Can we go back and recapture them from prior years? Next one, should an LLC or individual lease a car if it is to be used primarily for business purposes? What are the tax consequences between these types of ownership? What are the bookkeeping and tax implications of an LLC being taxed as a C-Corp? Can I deduct my real estate training seminar costs? We took the full depreciation for a lawnmower my husband purchased for his business the following year. We decided to dissolve the business. How does that affect our taxes? That's a really interesting one, by the way. There's going to be lots of different rules on that. And then for an investor planning on buying and holding real estate, do you recommend cost segregation? That'll be a good answer, too. What is the best way to utilize a 1031 exchange? Can income from self-employment be offset by the Tesla tax benefit? I am currently a W-2 employee as well as a real estate investor. Right now, my properties are in Schedule E. How does the tax return and tax rate change once I become a full-time real estate investor? Good questions. Let's see if we have any more. Yes, we're just going to dive right on into the first question. I'm just going to pull a box out of my way. First question is, what are the advantages and differences between the good old-fashioned C corporation, S corporation, and LLC? How do you know which one is best for you? So, Jeff, with your permission, I'm going to jump right on this one because this is kind of in our little bailiwick here. The C corporation, first off, I guess I have to understand that there's federal tax and there's state tax, and they don't always align. But there's also there's state entities, and then there's federal taxation of those state entities. So the first thing we look at is there's C corps, which really, there's just corporations, and they can either be taxed as a C corp, an S corp, and technically you could be taxed as a nonprofit. So there's really three types. They always say there's two types of for profit, S and C. A C corporation pays its own tax, so it's a flat 21% right now from a federal standpoint. States are going to vary. And if it's paying out profit, then the C corporation pays tax, and then it pays out what's called a dividend to its shareholders, and they pay long-term capital gains tax on that. So that's the dreaded double tax. The issue with C corps is that usually you're not paying anything out of them. You're like 80% of them, they're usually just going to zero out. You're using it to run a business and not generate a bunch of profit out of that particular business. Usually you're finding other ways to get the money out, including wages and things like that. S corporations pass the tax down to you. And the reason people like the S corp and the reason the accountants like S corps is because you avoid self-employment tax or what's called Social Security tax, FICA, old age, death and survivors, Medicare. It's all the same thing. And it avoids that on its profit. So you have to take a small salary, but after that, you get this money out that ordinarily, if you were making that money in your name as a sole proprietor or as a partner in a partnership, you would be taxed with that self-employment tax on top of it. It doesn't sound like maybe a ton. It's 15.3%. You get a partial deduction on some of it. It really pencils out to about 14% on the first 130,000, and then 2.9 after that with another phase up, depending on how much you make, up about 3.8. But it means that you paid, you avoid that whole issue if you're an S corporation. And then there's this LLC. And that LLC does not exist for federal tax purposes. You actually get to choose whether you want it to be a C corp, an S corp, partnership, or disregarded entity. So like whenever I see this question, it always thinks like this is a great learning opportunity for everybody. Just because I've been saying this for 20 something years, but you know, those LLCs, you set them up by the state, you can pick however you want it to be taxed. I mean, subject to, you know, a few little rules, but if it's you and a spouse, you really have your choice as to how you want it to be taxed. You could say, I want to be a C corp. I want to be an S corp. I want it to be a partnership. I want it to just be ignored, depending on where you live. And even a husband and wife in some states could be treated as a single taxpayer. And if you're in a community property state, that's the trick. And you don't have to file a tax return for it. So it really does become kind of fun when you start looking at these things. Then how do you know which one is best for you? It's facts and circumstances. It's impossible to know without knowing whether you need the money out of it, whether you're a high income earner. Like maybe you have, maybe it's a couple spouses, and one of them's I use an example that I just came across with a doctor, high income earner. The last thing they want is more money on their tax return. So in that particular case, I'm going to look at them and say, probably the C corp's going to be your friend because we don't need the money. Like you don't need it to live off of. Maybe we'll just pay a lot less right now and keep more of it, with the idea that in the future they could start drawing it out as a salary or things like that. Anyway, so how do I know which one's best for you? If you get someone who knows what they're talking about to apply facts and circumstances. And there's a really critical component that a lot of accountants miss. And they're so focused in on the tax that they don't focus on what it means to grow as a business. And so I'll use the example of somebody who's building a real estate portfolio. A wage becomes your friend. W-2 income becomes your friend when you're trying to build up the ability to borrow money to leverage into more real estate. If you take all your income away, nobody's going to loan you money. So we have to be cognizant of that when we're deciding on the appropriate entity. And if that's the case, then all of a sudden, conventional wisdom goes out the door when we're talking just tax. And all of a sudden you're weighing another component. Hey, I could get my taxes down to zero, but that just means nobody's going to loan me any money and I can't grow my business very fast. So maybe I should pay some tax. Maybe I should be paying some wages so I qualify for more loans so I can actually acquire more real estate. I hope that makes sense. Jeff, do you have anything you want to throw in?
No, I agree with that. We often see clients making business decisions based solely upon tax, and tax is just one factor in that decision-making process of what you're really trying to accomplish. So I agree with you completely.
Cool. Lots of questions already coming. Jeff, can you see the questions, by the way?
I can see, yes, I can see some of them.
All right, because I'm going to read them out.
Yeah, they have the old person font up here so I can see them.
All right, so I'm going to look and see if there's anything here. No, there's nothing that's really relevant to that one. All right, are taxes filed quarterly for a C-Corp? Jeff, I know you want to answer this one.
Yeah, taxes for a C-Corporation, you're filing a return annually. It's due 3.5 months after your fiscal year end. So when we talk about quarterly, what we're talking about is paying estimated income taxes for that corporation if the corporation is profitable. If you have a loss, if you have no income for the year, you're not required to make quarterly estimates. So again, those are just estimates towards your annual tax return. They're part of that computation of what you're going to owe at the end of the year. And that's really all there is to that. It's similar to like a 1040. Some people have to file quarterly estimates for personal reasons.
Yeah, I always look at it as that the tax system is a pay-as-you-go tax system. So do you have to file quarterly? It depends on whether you're going to owe money. If you don't owe any money, you're zeroing out your C-Corp, then no, you don't have to. If you are making a bunch of money or you're planning on making a bunch of money, then you're supposed to be paying as you go. So you're supposed to be paying quarterly taxes. And there might be some penalty for not doing it, but I always look at the penalties, and this is just me, so I don't want to impose this on anybody, but they're pretty low-interest loans. They're like 6%. Annually. So I don't get too worried about perhaps maybe not hitting a deadline or two. Like some people get really mad at them, but I don't. I always look and say, well, at least I have the money so I can keep growing. But it's always up to you. If you have a bunch of cash sitting around, and you know, then pay your tax on time. But if you're really like, hey, boy, I could turn this money into more money, then you may want to take that and say, hey, you know, there's a little bit of a penalty, but it's not draconian.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Can I pay family members who are employed by my corporation annually with the amount paid depending on revenue, or do I have to pay them at regular intervals throughout the year? So this is, to me, first off, you have federal laws and state laws, and there's no IRS rule or federal rule on how often you have to pay. So I tell people, if it's your company, I usually pay, like you could pay out of an S-Corp once a year if you really wanted to. I tell people, though, hey, you know what? Take a small amount and then bonus yourself at the end of the year. Like if you're just shoestringing it and you just don't want to pay for running payroll, then don't incur a bunch of extra expense. Like if that $100 or whatever it is going to really break you, then say, you know, hey, pay less often. If you have family working for you, and that's the big thing, then they're usually exempt under state law as to whether you have to pay on certain portions. There are laws on the books that say you have to pay employees on a regular basis in many, many states. If that's the case, we don't want to run afoul of state laws if someone's going to sue us. But there's exemptions when it comes to many family members. Is that the way you understand it too, Jeff?
Right. I mean, your immediate family members, your children, your spouse, your parents, those are all specifically exempted under the wage and hour laws. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to pay FUTA tax on your children or your spouse. And I don't think they come under the hours rules where if they work 40 hours, they have to be paid that week for the 40 hours.
No, you know, so I know that there's some rules with the IRS that say, hey, you can't unreasonably delay making payroll. So, you know, it's like, again, I tell people, if it's me, I'm taking a small amount. I might take it monthly. I might take it quarterly. As long as I'm doing some regular basis, that might be $1,000 a month or something. If I know that I'm going to take at least that. So like if I'm running an S corp and I'm making $100,000 a year and I know I'm going to be paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $35,000 out of it. That's just, I know it is. So I'm going to pay $1,000 a month, and then I'm going to bonus myself at the end of the year. Then you can play with the revenue a little bit. Technically, you're not supposed to be looking at this and making it merit-based simply because compensation supposed to be tied to, hey, this is tied to your time. So like if the IRS was to be really evil and try to audit the heck out of you, they'd want to see, all right, what did you do? Do you have any proof of what you did? You know, so they may take the other tact. When it's an S corp, again, it's really not going to matter. Even the court cases, it tends to be about one third is the magic number for payroll. There's no set rule on it. They just say reasonable pay. But every time you see one, it always seems to be about a third. But if it's taking out of a C corp, again, I have probably 80% of our C corp zero out. So it's like we're taking it out in other forms that are non-taxable, like accountable plans and 105, the medical reimbursements, and just reimbursing typical expenses that you have, the administrative office in your house, cell phones, internet, even car, all those things are coming out to you tax-free. So you're not really worried about running them through payroll. If you want to pay somebody payroll, and if you're coming out of, what is the third, somebody has asked, what is the one third rule? Uh-huh. It means in an S corp, if you make $100,000 and you take it all as a distribution, you just avoided paying 100% of Social Security taxes. They don't let you do that. They say you got to take some payroll and it's a reasonable amount, but the court cases all seem to come around to this one third. So we always say the rule of thumb, and this is not just me, but it's just about every accountant out there. It's going to say, hey, when in doubt, just pay yourself a third. And that means if it's profitable, make sure a third of that comes out. But that's technically not even the rule. The rule could be, hey, if you're making way more than that, then it's just whatever you could pay somebody to do your job. And that's what it is. And that's the only portion that pays Social Security. But it's also the portion that you could use to fund a 401k, a defined benefit. Like you could do some really cool stuff.
Now, I wanted to hit something else you talked about in the past with the salary from the S corporation is if you don't have income, you're not required to have salary. If you don't have distributions, you're not required to have salary.
Yeah, that's a fun one. I think we asked our staff that probably about 2 or 3 months ago. I like catching people with a gotcha. You can make $100,000 in an S corp, and if you don't distribute it, you're not required to take a salary. It's only when you distribute money. So if you make money in an S corp, it doesn't mean you have to take payroll. In fact, there's a lot of accounts on there that say, no, you made money, you have to take payroll. It's like, no, technically it's only if you distribute money, then you're supposed to be making sure. So if you're stockpiling cash, then technically you don't have to. But I think we beat that one to death. So let's go on to the next one. This is an interesting one, as we've written on this a lot and we've done some videos on this. Are there ways to handle the sale of a personal residence that has significant appreciation in order to reduce capital gains tax on the gains above the $500,000 married exemption? So they said the marriage exemption, it's really section 121, which is I've lived in it as my personal residence 2 out of the last 5 years. And as a single person, I can avoid capital gains or tax on $250,000 of capital gains. As a married couple, I can avoid tax on $500,000 of capital gains. The reason I say capital gains is because technically there's people that have rented their houses out before that have depreciation recapture. This does not cover that. This only covers capital gains. So I buy a house for $100,000. I sell it for $500,000. I'm married filing jointly, but I lived in it for 2 of the last 5 years. I pay zero tax. So what these folks are asking about is what if I bought in, let's say, Seattle, Bellevue, or the Bay Area, or Manhattan, someplace where everything just ran up in value. And let's say that I bought a house for $500,000, and 10 years later, I'm selling it at $2 million. And I have a $500,000 exclusion, so there'd be $1 million of taxable gain. And before everybody starts crying, say, well, if in California, that could be 13% state capital gains plus the 20% plus the, we're above 250,000. So we have the net investment income tax. So we have another, when we add all those things up, it comes out to about 37%. So that would be 370,000. So that's a pretty sizable chunk out of that amount because you only have this 500,000. So then people say, well, what do I do? Well, the easy thing to do is to say, hey, I want to take the $500,000, but I also don't want to pay any tax on it. If you're going to be buying more real estate, then what we need to do is convert that personal property, which is your house, into investment property, which means you need to rent it to somebody, then you can qualify for a 1031 exchange. And if you exchange it, then you don't have to pay any tax. You're deferring it into a new property, but you still capture the $500,000. So you actually change your basis. So people know 1031 exchanges because they say, hey, the basis rolls forward. So if I've had property and, you know, I've depreciated half of it and I'm going to sell it and buy a bunch more properties because it's gone up in value, you're just taking your basis from the first property and just rolling it into the new properties that you've exchanged it for. In this particular case, we want to get the best of both worlds. We want that $500,000 capital gains exclusion, and we don't want to pay tax on that extra million. So again, my example is $500,000. Let me see if I can actually get a pen to work on my computer here. Here we go. So let's say we have $500,000 basis. Then we want our $500,000 of exclusion. So we have $1 million. So we want that first $1 million to come away tax-free and roll into the new property. But then since we're selling it, since the sale price is $2 million, then we have an extra $1 million of gain. And this is what you can 1031 exchange. All you have to do is convert that personal property into rental property. And there's no hard and fast rules. In fact, there are cases where somebody wasn't even able to convert it. They never got a renter, but they tried. And they could show that they made a good faith effort to actually convert it into investment property, but they could not find a decent renter that was willing to pay the fair market rents. So I would say don't do that. Just know that the case is out there. So it's not again, draconian rules. These are pretty straightforward. You put this thing and you rent it for a few months. Is it worth $370,000 to convert that and then go buy? You still have to qualify under a 1031 exchange. So you still have to take that $2 million and buy real estate, but it could be a bunch of investment properties. It doesn't have to be another house that you live in. You could go buy apartment complex or go buy a bunch of single family residences. And somebody might be asking, well, what if I want to live in it? Well, buy it first as an investment property, leave it that way for at least 6 months or so, and then convert it back into your primary residence. The rules do contemplate that. Even under 121, it says if it had been part of a 1031 exchange within the last 5 years, you don't get that $500,000. So like, it already knows that people are going to do this. And by the way, where do we get that strategy? From the IRS. This is actually black letter law, so we don't have to. Somebody just said, can you 1031 exchange into a REIT? Technically, not really. You can do a Delaware, what is it called? A Delaware trust, and you can go into a TIC, but they don't let you just do something where it's managed by somebody else. Let's see. Can a primary
I've seen something similar to that where they do a 721 exchange into a partnership that ultimately becomes part of a REIT later on. But I've usually only seen that in like commercial buildings and things of that nature.
I just know that it has to go entity to entity. So if I am in a REIT individually, I have to buy individual. Like I can't even 1031 exchange a REIT. In fact, I don't even know how that would even be possible. I've seen people do deals where they're doing a TIC with somebody, a tenant in common, but you can't. Right. But it specifically says it can't be a partnership. So I don't know. I think it really has to be your real estate, and I don't think a REIT's going to qualify. But you know, I guess we could always, you know.
Yeah, I've never seen it done directly. I don't think that works.
Yeah, there's a bunch of other questions. Let's see. So the 1031s. So I just asked, primary residence in a foreign country. No, you're not going to I think the 121, I believe it's U.S. properties only. I'm not sure. Do you know that one off the top of your head, Jeff?
Not off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
I know 1031s are U.S. property only, but I'm pretty sure that this is just on U.S. capital gains because we don't know what's going on in all those other countries. But and does the conversion from a primary residence to a rental property impact the two of the last 5 years to get the $500,000? It does. But remember, it's not I lived in it the last 2 years. It's two of the last 5 years. So I could rent it for up to 3 years and still get my $500,000 exclusion. Somebody else said U.S. only.
On the foreign 1031, you can do a foreign 1031, but it has to go into another foreign property. You cannot 1031 into a domestic property from a foreign property.
Okay. Yep. So, yeah, U.S. property, foreign. Somebody says installment sale on part of the proceeds. Well, see, now you're going to draw me back in. All right. So this is where it gets really fun. So let me go back to where it is. There we go. The 1030. So let's go back to this. What if we wanted, what if we were, go back in time and before we did the, the Delaware statute, someone just emailed in, what about the 1031 exchange into a Delaware statutory trust? And you can shelter all your recapture, true or not? Yes, you can go into a Delaware statutory trust. It's considered real estate. So that would be, I said Delaware trust, but it's just a Delaware statutory trust. The IRS ruled that real estate in a Delaware statutory trust is real estate. So you can exchange into that if you really wanted to. So let's say we go back in time and you're in that same scenario where the person bought the house for $500,000 and the house is eventually going to be worth $2 million, but what they really want to do is keep it as an investment property. You can sell it to an S corp that you own, and you can actually, in that particular case, you can do an installment sale back to yourself from the S corp and then opt out of the installment sale rules out of the S corp so you can take the entire let's say we sold it for $1 million, so we have $500,000 a gain. You could actually up your basis to $1 million, not pay tax, and then you have a great little rental property there that has twice as much basis as if you just turned it into an investment property. So like, there's some little moving pieces here. It gets kind of fun when we're talking about these. So we'll have to keep going. All right, next one. We formed a corporation in 2014. We only started taking reimbursements within the last year. Can we go back and recapture them from prior years? Jeff, what say you?
Well, if you're a cash basis corporation, I would suggest that you reimburse in the current year for those missed years that you're just now reporting the expenses. So you would actually be deducting the expenses in the current year. You do have to kind of watch as to a lot of these plans have specific time periods that you can reimburse in, particularly like the medical reimbursement, I believe usually has to be reimbursed within the next first quarter of the following year. So you can't go back real far on some of these expenses. But for I believe for other expenses, whether it's mileage or some of those, maybe home office, you could probably do that, reimburse currently for past year's expenses. Thoughts, Toby?
Yeah, no, I'm looking at, when I first read this, I looked at it in a couple different ways. I said, first off, maybe we have a bunch of expenses and maybe we should be capturing them. If it's 2014, maybe we should just be capturing them as loans to the corporation. Corporations should be writing it off. It depends on whether it made money or not. Corporations are generally going to be a cash basis taxpayer if it's a small one. If you're making a whole bunch of money, then it makes no sense not to have reimbursed yourself. And then maybe it makes sense to look at those and call them loans and get some interest out of the company to yourself as well. But I'm assuming that this is probably a shoestring corporation is probably just zipping along and it needs to, and you just don't have the money right now to reimburse, then I would say, yeah, whenever that corporation can actually reimburse you is when it actually gets to write it off. So I use Krispy Kremes in all my examples, but if I went in and I brought Anderson in an event and I brought in a bunch of Krispy Kremes and it owed me $100, Anderson can't write off the $100 until it pays me. But if it goes from one tax year to another, then it writes it off when it actually pays me. I don't know a better way to put that. I like Krispy Kremes.
Well, you got to go with donuts, I mean.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's see. What about education mentorship for trading futures from the previous year? Yeah, again, it's whenever you write the check. So somebody asked, well, what if I incurred a bunch of expense last year and I'm just now making money? Yes, then you can write it off now. Like if you go past a tax year, and just keep in mind that your tax year is not necessarily your corporation's tax year. A C corp could be September year end, your year end's December. So we always have to look and say, all right, which tax year are we in and which entity and when did they actually pay it? Those are really important. So that's the kind of things that you look at. But yeah, we'll go back in and get it. You just, unfortunately, the answer is always going to be kind of this. It depends. You got to make sure you have people that actually know the rules. And then you go back. Somebody says, what if I don't make money for a few years? Then the conventional wisdom is going to be, Jeff, like, this, how would you handle somebody that, you know, for 3 years, they're just going to be reinvesting every dollar and dumping in some extra cash. Are you going to take the loss and carry it forward? I mean, that's if it's a C corp. If it's an S corp, you may be, depending on what your basis is, you may be taking that loss and taking it personally.
Yeah, I would like to capture those expenses as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think the closer to the date that they actually happen, the better off you are.
And technically, an accountable plan says that there needs to be payment within a reasonable time. And they usually say submit it and pay it within 90 days. You go above, you know, beyond, it's not like it's a death knell, but you probably should be saying, hey, this is, I gave you this money to your corporation. You now owe it back to me, but you've spent it. So they capture the expense. If it's a C corp, it just shows as a loss and they carry it forward.
So education in particular, and James says it was a substantial amount. That's something that in 2015 probably would have been capitalized and amortized, meaning we did not take the whole expense in the first year.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we can pay it 3 or 4 years later and then just expense the whole amount. I think that presents its own issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Let's jump on to the next one. We have a whole bunch of questions coming. So, you know what? I'm going to go back to that just because it seems like we've gotten a couple. Somebody spent $30,000 in education. They said, what's the last year I could do it? Or let's see, what if I don't make money for a few years? Then I would make sure that you're capturing that. It depends on when you're going through it. So it kind of goes like this. If I do a mentorship when I'm starting up a company before I actually form it, then I'm capturing that as a startup expense. If I form a company and I do a mentorship to help me in the company, that's a current expense. So I would be writing that off as a what's called a 162 expense, as an ordinary necessary business expense that I would just be taking now, even if I can't pay it. Like if I paid it individually, I would just call that a shareholder loan. I would take the $30,000 loss on the books of the entity, so that I'm just the next when I make $30,000 in the entity, it's not paying any tax on. It's the same difference, and I pay myself back. It's the same. We get to the same place. I get to write it all off. It's just I'd rather do it sooner than later. Somebody else asked, if one pays for education in 2015, what is the last year to take it off on taxes? Unfortunately, really, it depends, Catherine, because there's really not a timeline. Everybody talks about startup expenses and they say, hey, go back 12 months or this, that, and the other. There's no hard and fast rule. It's anything in the investigation of starting up a company. So if you spend a bunch of money, I'm still grabbing it, even if it's a few years later. If I can show that there's a line between what you are doing and what you're doing right now and formalizing that business, I'm still going to go grab it. I'm just going to capitalize it. If, on the other hand, I had an existing business and I spent money in that business. So let's say that I'm a plumbing and I go to my plumbing internship course and I spend $30,000 and I did it a few years back, I really should be expensing that when I actually incurred it. But if it still owes me the money and then I finally pay it back, I'm writing it off in the year that I pay myself back. Technically, you should have been carrying that on your books. The IRS is going to say, what the heck? Did this really occur? You're going to have to prove it. But you will, after 3 years, you're not going back in and reopening your books. Maybe you're outside the audit category. Realistically, you're just going to want to grab that whenever it pays you back and expense it that particular year. Again, it's much easier if you had it up and running business as opposed to if you were preparing to do one. Jeff, do you have anything else you want to add on that? Are we good?
We're good.
Cool. All right. This is a question we get some version of it just about every time, which is, should an LLC or individual lease a car if it is to be used primarily for business purposes? What are the tax consequences between these types of ownership? So a lot of times when the lawyers look at things, it's different than the way an accountant's going to look at it. So I'm just going to give you the attorney standpoint, which is whenever you bring a car into a business, you're bringing liability into that business because the car doesn't actually drive itself. It's always the driver who creates the liability. And if that driver is now driving a company car, it creates the inference that the company is now responsible for anything that driver does. So you always want to make sure that if you're bringing a car into a business, that you're carrying the right type of insurance so that if you do have something bad happen in that vehicle, it doesn't toast your business. Because the first thing that's going to happen, the company car, then you are presumed to be on company business, right? The other thing is, then we look at it from somebody just said automated cars could be changing that. Yeah, who's responsible for the automated car? Then it gets even more fun. Then you're pretty much guaranteeing that it's going to be the business. But the reason people like to put vehicles in businesses is because they think it's going to give them a huge tax benefit. And sometimes that's true, depending on the vehicle. There's different rules for different size cars, whether it's a 6,000-pound gross vehicle weight vehicle or not. Then you may get to write off the purchase price, which is great. Congratulations. But it's a one time, that's it. And now you've created more than likely a taxable event for yourself every year beyond that. And this is why. When a business has a car, first off, it has to make sure that it's more than 50% business usage. Otherwise, you don't get to do those types of write-offs. If it is greater than 50% business usage, then whatever portion you use individually is taxable to you as wages. Not just, hey, we're going to have to allocate some money to you. No, it's like if I gave you a car, said, hey, you're going to work for me. I'm going to give you a brand new Mercedes that you get to drive as part of your employment. You're paying tax on the lease value of that vehicle. So there's going to be a tax hit to you, including the Social Security and withholding. And people don't realize that quite often. And so they'll stick a vehicle in a business and they're not paying any tax on it. The IRS still wants you to track the mileage, which I would suggest using Mile IQ. And then it's going to look at it and say, by the way, did you ever fall below that 50%? Because now that's personal property and you need to recapture all that depreciation you took. And if your head's going, what the heck? Then this is why we tell you not to do it. It's complicated and there's unintended consequences. The easiest thing to do is just reimburse mileage. It doesn't matter what vehicle you're driving. If you're in the vehicle and you're driving it, I mean, it's your car, doesn't matter whether you lease it or own it, whether you paid cash for it or whether you're financing it. I think it's 58 cents a mile. It just reimburses you and doesn't care which vehicle you're in. So if you have a Jeep and the Mercedes and a 1996 Ford F-150, it doesn't matter. Still 58 cents a mile. It's going to be reimbursing. And you never have to report that. And the company just gets to write it off. Now you're not messing around with this depreciation and writing it off. And again, I always kind of say, sometimes we make messes for ourselves because we're trying to write something off. Now, somebody says, can we rent our own car to ourselves to justify not having personal use? Eric, no, because it's you. If the company's renting it to you, then you have to pay the company. Otherwise, it's below fair market value lease. And not only do you have the state tax on it, but you also have income tax on it too. So it's no bueno, as my wife would say. Anything you wanted to add on that, Jeff? Because I was going off on a diatribe.
No, that's fine. The only thing I was thinking of was IRS considers company cars as low-hanging fruit. It doesn't make them an audit risk in themselves, but if you do come up under audit, they're going to look really hard at your vehicles that are company-owned. They're going to ask if you have other vehicles you drive and the mileage on those vehicles. And what they're ultimately trying to come to is that, no, that vehicle wasn't really 100% business use or even 80 or 90% business use. You don't really come under that when you're reimbursing for that business mileage. You do have to have records, but that's about it.
You're always required to keep a mileage log. So these people that buy a company car and say, aha, I'm just using it for business, doesn't matter. You better be able to show that you have another vehicle that you're commuting there and that there better be a car yard where all the cars reside. Otherwise, they're going to say you went home with it. So every day you're driving it. That's personal use. If it's sitting at an office, like in a yard, for example, a construction yard, and you only drive it when you're at the office, but you have a vehicle that you drive there every day, that's a different case. But then you might be able to get away with 100%, but you're going to have to show that that's actually it, that you're not taking it home. And I've seen these blow up people's faces more often than once. And I wish I had a nickel for every time I saw 100% business use vehicle that was the only vehicle that the person owned.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, they're just not going to buy it. They're like, you better have two cars. Don't. I mean, if it's a family, you better have three, you know, so you better have one that's just dedicated. Otherwise, save yourself the headache. You can have three cars and you can reimburse them all. 58 cents a mile. It just matters which one you put the mileage on, right?
That's right.
All right. What are the bookkeeping and tax implications of an LLC being taxed as an S or as a C corporation? So this is a fun one because we kind of touched on it earlier that, you know, the LLC is a state designation. You file that with the state. So it always depends on how expensive it is. So, for example, in Nevada, the LLC is cheaper than the C Corp. So we'll probably go with the LLC, right? If it's a professional organization where they require that you're a certain type of entity, we'll look at that. But if we're just looking at it from a tax standpoint, let's forget all that stuff and say it's an LLC and we elect to tax it as a C Corp. Tax bookkeeping implications are the same as a C Corp. It is literally the IRS looks at it and says, we expect to see a C Corp tax return. The bookkeeping requirements are the same no matter what you are, whether you're a sole proprietor or a partnership or an S Corp or a C Corp, you are required to keep books and records. And good luck getting a definition of what that means out of the IRS. Right? They'll say record of your income and expenses and records of your assets and liabilities. That's about all they're going to give you.
Yeah, the only difference I've ever seen with an LLC being taxed as a C corp is an LLC taxed as a C corp is not going to have common stock.
Which means
virtually nothing to you. Whereas a regular corporation, it will have common stock. It's just an equity account. Everything else is pretty much going to be the same between all C corporations.
The place that's going to come in, that common stock, is something called a 1244 stock loss.
Correct.
So if you lose money in a C corp, and here's the difference between the two. So let's say you're getting into a business where you may or may not make money. Your intent is to make money, but there's a good chance you're going to get slaughtered. You're going into a high risk profession or something. And you know you're going to spend, let's say you're married, filing jointly, and you know you're going to spend $75,000 trying to get this business off the ground. And after $75,000, you pull the plug on it. If it's a C corp, I can write that off against my ordinary income. If it's an LLC, that's a capital loss, and I'm still getting to write off the 75, but I'm only going to be writing it off as a stock loss.
Right. Because what 1244 says is it's an election you make when you form your corporation, saying that I'm treating my stock as small company stock. Well, an LLC doesn't have stock, so they're not subject to that 1244.
That's the only thing that I've ever noticed as being a big difference. People are used to the nomenclature of a C-Corp, board of directors, who are the officers. When an LLC, it could be manager managed or member managed. And you could still have president, vice president. You just have to choose to
write
them your operating agreement.
But, yeah, as far as bookkeeping and tax, the only other difference is going to be probably more influenced by what you're actually doing, your industry, your business, rather than what type of entity it is.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. 2 in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
So, fun question. Good question. We've gotten a ton of questions that came in as a result because we're talking about bookkeeping. Somebody says Quicken or QuickBooks. Quicken, I think, is only for I don't even think you can use it on a C Corp. Can you use Quicken on a C Corp, Jeff? You may know
Quicken's kind of a one-sided.
It's for sole proprietorships, I thought.
Yeah, it's based on small companies. Like you said, your Schedule C. If you have a balance sheet, it's not really good for it. QuickBooks is a far better software. It is also more expensive, but it's kind of hard to compare the two.
Yeah, QuickBooks is the gold standard. Everybody uses QuickBooks that does this stuff, but that's just because it does so much. Now, it could be overkill. If you're doing little stuff, small little business, or you have a rental business, you might want to just use spreadsheets.
Right.
You don't need to go and buy this software. The tax laws were written at a time before QuickBooks existed. You used to write down in a little ledger. Jeff, didn't you use slate tablets with chalk?
No, they were stone and chisel.
They use an abacus.
They had to be fairly thick, so if the dinosaurs stepped on them, they wouldn't break the tablets.
All right. Somebody says, a question similar to getting a car under your LLC. Can you use your LLC for getting an apartment, as I have to do my work research for REI at home? That becomes house hacking. So no. So anytime you're getting a value, so like an LLC, yes, it can have an apartment. If you're using one of the units, and I guess there's nothing against you using it. That's just you're carving out that you're not depreciating that one particular unit. So the great example is if you have a duplex, you live in one half and the other half is for a rental, you're not writing off 100% of the depreciation, you're cutting it in half.
Right.
So when you do this and you actually occupy a portion yourself, there's a tax implication to it. That's all I can say. But do you get to write, it's still an investment property, so it doesn't really change that. Jeff, do you have anything on that?
Once you start adding personal use to that, that becomes complicated.
You have a 20 unit and you're just 1/20th of everything now, it becomes personal expense. You can't write it off.
Yeah. You might have a superintendent or an office that they work out of, and that will be a deductible expense, but it can't be for your apartment. Again, that's personal use and the old 1/20th.
Yeah, and if you're using it all for business, like you have a personal use unit that's 100% for business, it could still write it off. It's just writing it off as a reimbursement to you. And so you're still saying, hey, this is my apartment. This is where I'm residing for just my business. Like maybe you have another home. This isn't your personal residence, but this is a residence that, but it's 100% being used for the office, then it can reimburse you. And it's even reimbursing you the depreciation and everything else. So like it's still going back in your pocket. It's still going to be a deduction. It's just, again, people tend to get an idea that, hey, I can get this free money and it's this depreciation and all this stuff. And it's not quite that way. When it's personal property, there is no such thing as depreciation. And that gets us back to this fun stuff. Let's see. Somebody says stock loss in an LLC, but not a corp. I thought that was C corp loss can be written off as ordinary income. And LLC can be written off as stock loss. Did I get that backwards? No, you got that right. LLC is written off as a stock loss. The ordinary income of a C corp when you dissolve it is 1244 stock loss. And you get to write off up to, for married filing jointly, $100,000 of your wages or any other income. Somebody says Quicken is for personal, not for business. So I think that's sole proprietors, right?
Yeah, it's similar to my Microsoft Money, the old program that I used it for personal and some business. But going back to what you said about the spreadsheets, I mean, if you have, say, half dozen rental properties and that's all there is, it's sometimes easier to do the spreadsheet than try to make it work in QuickBooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, again, I always kind of look at it and say that there's no reason for you to invest in software if you can track your expenses pretty easily. The reason you use software is either you're doing books for somebody else or you have hundreds of transactions that you're tracking on a monthly basis.
Right.
You know, if it's, I don't want to use a rule of thumb, but let's just say less than 100, you could probably track that on a spreadsheet just through your bank statements. You could figure it out. And then your accountant's the one who has to weed through that. But you're just keeping track of here's what I spent it on. Doesn't have to be all these crazy columns and look all pretty. Somebody says, what type of business equipment can you totally write off in the year you put it into service? Anything that's less than a 20-year useful life is under bonus depreciation, so you can write that off. And it's not just equipment. It's literally just about everything right now. That'll shift in the next couple of years, start to phase out. But right now, we have 100% bonus depreciation. Somebody says, I won't get into these LLC things. Yes, we'll keep going on. Can I deduct my real estate training seminar costs? Jeff, how do you want to answer this one? Because I've answered this one on previous. I'd like to hear your verbiage.
Oh, my verbiage. Can I deduct my real estate training seminar costs? Well, as we discussed previously, are you doing real estate training before you took this training? I'm sorry, are you dealing in real estate before you took the training? That's a pretty big factor. It also depends on where you want to deduct this. If you're wanting to deduct it on a Schedule C, we're probably going to tell you no.
There's a really good case that it was actually somebody who went through one of our classes and their accountant didn't agree with us. And then we see them a few years later and they're a tax case. Yep. And it was the situation where he was going to get into real estate. He was going to flip. And his accountant said, no problem writing it off on his personal return as a Schedule C deduction as a sole proprietor. We said, no, that's not our reading of the code. We believe you need to be either in that business or you need to grab it as a startup expense, which means you're amortizing it over a period of years. And the accountant didn't agree. The taxpayer ended up paying the price because he was disallowed all of his deductions because they said basically what we told him, which is, either you're already in the real estate business, you already own property, in which case now you can write it off. Or if you're not, then at best it's a startup expense.
Yep.
And you're not taking that personally. You're not allowed to.
I mean, I've seen several cases in the past 2 years where people have attempted this on deduction on Schedule C and it has not ended well for them. They've had to pay back taxes in the thousands of dollars.
You guys have heard me say this before on this. If you've never been on a Tax Tuesday, you're going to hear me say this term, accountable plan. You can only have accountable plans if you're an employee of an organization and get the benefit. In other words, the company can only reimburse you as an employee if you're actually an employee. And there's only two types of organizations that you can be a part of as an individual where you're the owner and be treated as the employee, which is a S corp and a C corp. And that could be an LLC tax as an S corp or an LLC tax as a C corp. Doesn't matter. those can have accountable plans. If you're a sole proprietor, I'm sorry, you're not an employee. Otherwise, Ricardo has pointed out that a nonprofit could do that too. But for a for-profit entity, if we're trying to make money for ourselves, then I need to be I need to be treated as an employee. Now, there's folks out there that'll say, hey, maybe your spouse could be an employee if you're a sole proprietor. Yes, they can. And then they can try to cover you like under a medical plan and stuff. Still, your expenses that it's reimbursing, that's what we care about. It needs to be you and it needs to be paying it back. So you want to make sure that you're in a situation where it's reimbursing you your expenses. And if you went to a class, let's say that you worked for Boeing. And the reason I say this is because I went to school with a whole bunch of Boeing folks going and getting their MBAs. And you're coming out of pocket. You're driving there. You're buying books. You're paying the tuition. And Boeing is reimbursing you. That's how they did it. They reimbursed it or they paid it direct. But if you came out of pocket, they just wrote you a check. You didn't report that on your tax return. Boeing wrote it off as an employee expense. That's what you want. An accountable plan is any reimbursed expense. It is not included in your wages. It is not included in your taxable income. It is not subject to withholding, and it includes a whole gamut of things. Somebody just said, is it just healthcare? No, it's anything that you pay out of your pocket that's for the benefit of the company, including having an administrative office in your home. It could reimburse you for all of the expenses associated with that office, and then everything you're driving around and doing from that point forward, you're leaving your office when you have an administrative office in your house, and everything becomes business mileage. That's why it's so critical to actually have an SRC corp floating around out there, or Ricardo, a nonprofit, and just having a corporation. Let's just put it that way. So an LLC taxes a corporation or a corporation. So you have to have one of those because nothing else qualifies. It makes life really easy. And we see people try to get around it all the time. And it's like, why? It's black and white. Make it really easy. Why make it so hard? Someone says, what's that bonus depreciation? That means you can write off anything that's less than 20-year property in the year that you put it into service. So you can write off literally just about, we'll get into this when we talk cost segregation here in a second. It'll be fun. Now you have something to look forward to, right? We took the full depreciation for a lawnmower my husband purchased for his business. The following year, we decided to dissolve the business. How does this affect our taxes? Ooh, this is so exciting. Jeff, do you want to go first or do you want me to hit this?
No, I can do this. So this is an example of the bonus depreciation. One of two things possibly happened. If this business was profitable, they could have taken Section 179 and deducted the whole amount for the purchase of the lawnmower. If it wasn't profitable, then it was more likely bonus depreciation from 2018. They just depreciated the full amount. Now, the difference between the two is bonus depreciation, if you shut down the business, doesn't get recaptured as income. The equipment can be distributed to the owners, assuming this is either most likely a Schedule C. So it could be distributed to the owners with no tax implications. If it's Section 179, then the entire amount of the deduction is recaptured as income. And the reason for that is Section 179 is a deduction for what normally would have been 7 years to depreciate this equipment. They're letting you have it all up front. And if you don't keep it for the whole 7 years, then IRS wants their money back. So that's the primary difference between the bonus depreciation and the 179. So again, it's going to depend on how this was originally depreciated. Yep. It might not have any tax implications. It might have quite a bit of tax implication.
Well, there's a couple of things they said here. So first off, they bought a lawnmower. So let's assume that it's a real estate business and they're writing it off as an expense associated with that business. It used to be, and by the way, they use the modified accelerated cost recovery system, the MACRS that you always see. Somebody will say it's 5-year property or 7-year property. So let's say that a lawnmower will probably be 5-year property. What that means is that you write it off over 5 years. So if you spent, $300 on it, you're going to take 1/5 every year. So you're going to take about $60 in each one. I don't know what the number is. I'm probably off, right? No, maybe I got that one right. If you had a 179 deduction, which is a section that would say, it used to be like $25,000 a year, you can immediately expense, and they jumped it all the way up to $1 million. Mm-hmm. If you wrote that off, then the rules were that you just couldn't create a loss with it, but that you could write off any equipment that you bought and put into service that year. So people would do this. They would buy something and finance it so they could create a big loss. in the year that they put it into service. So let's say that you bought that lawnmower on a credit card, even though you haven't paid for the lawnmower personally, like the business is now obligated on that credit card, or you may be obligated to pay on the credit card, but the cash has not come out of your pocket, but you've obligated yourself, you would get to write that off in that year that you bought it. The catch is that if it fell below the 50% used for business threshold, you had to pay tax on it all as though you never expensed it in the first place, or you'd go back over to that 5 year and you'd get, you know, in this particular case, let's say the individual used it for 1 year, dissolved the business, which means they wrote off 5 years in 1 year, they would only get $60 of deduction. They would have to recapture the $240 as taxable income if they took it as 179. If they took it as bonus depreciation, different story. Would there be any tax implication to them having received that lawnmower, Jeff?
No, because they're receiving it at a zero basis. And technically, if they turn around and sold it personally for, say, $1,000, their basis would be a zero. And at that point, they'd have to recognize a gain on the sale of that mower.
The only other thing we're assuming that this business is a flow through. If it's a C Corp, then we have a little bit of a different animal, just because you're receiving, like, you've already, again, I don't know what you do with things that are written off completely. But if you're handing out assets to the shareholders after the fact, and I guess if there was... I'm trying to think of a situation.
Well, an S Corp kind of runs into the same thing, that you have to distribute things at fair market value, not at their cost.
Yeah.
And partnerships work differently, at that they get distributed at cost, not fair market value.
Yep. So they get it distributed at cost. Is there a tax hit on it, or are they getting it because they paid $300 for the lawnmower, let's just say. So you're getting $300 worth of value.
Right. That's already been written off. So
yeah. Would there be a tax on the $300?
No.
Right. So they're just considered a distribution it would be part of their capital account calculation, I assume.
So Robert has a good question. What about if the lawnmower was expensed, maybe under the de minimis safe harbor rules? So the de minimis safe harbor rules that say that you can do repairs and maintenance per invoice per item of up to $2,500. And immediately expenses as repairs and maintenance. So if this lawnmower, I was thinking this was probably a heavy duty lawnmower, but if this was, say, a $500 lawnmower, they could write this off under the de minimis rules, expense it as repairs, and you're done.
Because you're just going out there and doing the lawn.
Yeah, because you're immediately writing it off as a repair or maintenance, and it's not an asset anymore.
You can see that. That'd be interesting. That'd probably be the best route to do, wouldn't it?
Right. Now, if you're talking about, I'll bring up my mother again, a $5,000 mower.
Mom doesn't mess around. Your mom has a $5,000 mower.
Well, she's got a 30-acre farm that she has to take care of, so.
We're going to make fun of you so badly. I'm just teasing. I'm thinking of all the horrible things you could say. Your mom has it's not even.
You should see her with her chainsaw.
Yeah. Oh my.
So if it's more expensive, you're not going to fall into this de minimis safe harbor. And can bonus depreciation only be taken when you're running at a loss for a C Corp? Bonus depreciation can be taken on any entity, including personal, as long as the life of the asset that you purchase, the equipment, land improvements is 15 years. But as long as it's under 20 years, you can take that bonus depreciation.
Yep. Isn't that cool? Yeah. So the accountable plan is when you're giving yourself back money is very expenses. So like you have a cell phone. So let's have the business write you a check for all your cell phone expenses. If it's for the benefit of the business, like I'm using it. Hey, you're in real estate. You need to have a flipping cell phone. So we can reimburse you 100% of your costs on that cell phone. But I have to be able to do an accountable plan in order to do that. Otherwise it's a proportionate.
Right.
In the situation where you have depreciation, that is just any taxpayer, as long as you're getting an asset where you get to depreciate it. Works out.
Yeah. And some of these items that look like real estate really aren't. And my prime example is a swimming pool is not real estate. That's a 15-year land improvement. So you put a pool in, that puppy's able to take bonus depreciation.
I take that action. All right, so we have a bunch more. How do we go over already? Is it already been too many Christmas? I thought it was like 30 minutes in.
We got a little windy on some of them.
Yeah.
Not you. It was me.
For an investor planning on buying and holding real estate, would you recommend cost segregation? So this is interesting. So when you say investor, so I mean, we're buying and holding real estate. So that we're going to, this is long term. So this isn't a flipper. Cost segregation just means this, and I'm going to write this up so you guys can kind of follow along. So if you have rental, and we'll just call it residential, single family residence, you write off the value of the house, the improvement on that property over 27.5 years. So if it's, so let's say that you buy a house for $350,000 and the land value is $75,000. That means the improvement, the house itself is worth $275,000. You would divide that by 27.5, which is going to give you $10,000 a year of depreciation. So that's standard depreciation. This is the modified accelerated cost recovery. So whatever that is, MACRS. And correct me if I get anything wrong, Jeff, you're the accountant.
I'm watching you.
Let's say that we have rents coming in at $10,000 a year. We just wouldn't pay any tax on it. And we're talking net rental. But what if we have net rent coming off of this of $30,000 a year? So we have $30,000 a year coming in positive minus the 10. That gives me total taxable income of $20,000. When does it make sense to try to jump this number, this $10,000 up? What if I could make that higher? And that's when you do the cost segregation. Because let's say I'm in the highest tax bracket in a state like New York, Connecticut, California, something with a high state tax, Baltimore, you name it, or Maryland, Baltimore's in a state, Maryland. I know people are making fun of me. I'm making fun of myself. $20,000, that's going to get hit pretty hard, in some cases 50%. So I don't want that $20,000 to hit me. Then I may look at this and say, hey, instead of looking at it in taking the traditional MACRS sense, I'm going to break this down into items that are less than 20-year property and the structure of it. So, for example, if I walk into a house and there's a chandelier in it, that chandelier isn't part of the structure. I could break it off and write it off over a shorter period of time. Or there's heater covers or, you know, everything from HVAC to your boiler to you name it, to your, you know, whatever's in that house. Appliances, everything else, you break these things out. They're not part of the structure. And if I break those out, I can write those off right now with bonus depreciation all in the first year. And the rule of thumb, I'm just going to say rule of thumb is 20% is about what you're going to get in that first year. So rule of thumb is I would get an additional, just multiply that by 20%. So $55,000, I would get an additional $55,000. So I wouldn't pay any tax on that. Let's say I'm making $20,000 a year. It would be a good 2.5 years before I'd be looking at a taxable event. And by that time, maybe I bought more property and I keep bonus depreciating. Now, that's the classic sense when you do a cost seg is when you have either too much money coming in or there's a flip side. If you have one spouse who is a high net income earner, so they're making a lot of money. One spouse is making a lot of money, spouse one, and spouse two can qualify as a real estate professional. And then you can create losses through the use of cost segregation to subtract from this. So you get a loss so you can lower their income. That's the typical times when you're doing cost segregation. I hope that was in English so you guys could follow it. So whenever you're buying and holding real estate, it just becomes what's your tax appetite. If you're already creating losses and you're just carrying them forward because you're not a real estate professional, and a real estate professional is when you hit 750 hours, it's your number one use of time and you materially participate in your real estate activities. If you hit those tests, then you could be able to take real estate losses and offset active income with your real estate loss. And Louise, you can do cost seg for both commercial and residential. It used to be it was just commercial. Now you can do it against a single family house. It was never cost beneficial before, but now you can get them done. I've seen them done for $1,500. So you get a big old fat write-off if you're doing the cost seg. And it's whether or not you can get the benefit out of it. So what about renting a condo, which has window upgrades, is this cost segregation? Probably not. It depends on what the value of the condo is. But yeah, you break it all down and say, I just had a whole bunch of windows done. Yeah, maybe those aren't going to be 27 and a half year property. That's going to be much less. And I'll probably get to write them off in the year that I did it. It all depends. So it's a little calculation that you do. But I can tell you that the bigger your tax appetite, the better. And then it says, if you become a real estate professional and a tax year, after you did the cost seg and carryover losses, can you write it off, or is it trapped passive loss? It's trapped if you are an investor before. Real estate professional is only for the year. Jeff, am I misstating that, or is that your understanding
too? No, that's correct. And the other side of that problem is when you become a real estate professional, you have to aggregate all of your real estate activities together into one activity.
Yeah. This is one of the most misunderstood areas where, and unfortunately, it's because we had a bad court case that came out, and they didn't understand real estate professional, and whoever was convincing them, like, they were all wrong, and so the court was wrong. But there's two tests. There's the 750 hours, number one use of your work time, which one spouse has to qualify for, and then probably.
So what wouldn't it even make more sense if it's commercial property? Because there you're looking at 39 year life instead of 27 and a half year life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you're going to get much juicier amounts when you have a commercial property with $1 million and you're able to get an extra $200,000 write off right now. And if you're never planning on really selling it, like you're going to hold it, maybe you're going to trade it for more real estate, you'll never pay tax on that cost seg. Like, all you have to do is eventually pass away and your basis steps up. So it's one of those things where if you just sit there and let it happen, oh yeah, test for the real estate professional. It's two requirements. See, I get lost. Sorry, guys. Blonde. All right. So you have the real estate professional, which either spouse can pass. And then you have the material participation in your real estate activities, which is a material participation is to combined the spouses spend 500 hours or 100 hours. And it's the most time spent on your properties than anybody else. Or you did all of the time on your real estate, in which case we don't care about how many hours. So that's material participation, but that is per property. So when you do the material participation, it is per property unless you choose to aggregate it. If you aggregate all of your rental properties, then you just apply it to one. So let's say I have 10 pieces of real estate and I spend 50 hours on each one. And it doesn't matter whether it's me or a spouse because we add it all up together. But I would not pass the real estate professional test, even if I did the 750 hours, because each, yet 750 hours per year, but it's each property, I would have to be either I'm doing all the management or I'm doing 100 hours total and nobody else is spending more on each property, unless I choose to treat them all as one activity and then I don't. But I actually have to make an affirmative election, and accountants miss this, guys. You wouldn't believe it. There's court cases where people spent more than 700 hours, 750 hours, and they could show it. But then the IRS looked at it and appropriately said, but you didn't aggregate your properties. You had a bunch of properties, but each one you'd have to meet the hourly test. And they had management companies. So you're basically having to meet the 100-hour test on each property at least, or you do 500 hours total and you don't have to care. So this is something that says, are you considered a real estate professional if you have a property management company? You still could. It's 750 hours and you materially participate. That's it. You don't have to, like, and it's 750 hours, but it's the number one use of your time. So it can push the 750 hours up. If you spend 1,000 hours in your day job, for example, but you spend 1,001 hours in real estate, then you would meet the real estate professional standard. But if you did 1,000 hours in something else and 750 hours in your real estate activity, you would not meet it because it's not your number one use of time. What if my day job is a real estate agent? Then as long as you're involved in real estate transactions, you're in the buying and selling of real estate, then it qualifies. So you would meet the 750 hour test. So we have somebody says, what if my day job is a real estate agent? This is a great example. Let's say that I have three rental properties and I want to qualify as a real estate professional. You would say, hey, they meet the 750 hour test. They may be doing 2,000 hours, but then they have to materially participate in their rental activities too. Somebody says, because that is what I did pass with the IRS. Absolutely. So you qualified under both tests. So you still have to spend time on your rental properties. So yeah, you guys are now jumping all in. So I love that. So people are out there backing this one. All right, let's jump back in. What is the best way to utilize a 1031 exchange? So Jeff, do you want to play with the 1031 exchange, or do you want me to keep going?
Oh, you're doing great. I'm just listening here and learning. And
oh, stop it. He's still mad about his mom's tractor. Your mom drives a tractor. Like, I was just thinking back to the elementary school. Everybody always say, your mom wears combat boots.
Well, yeah. Let me say this. Mm-hmm. About 1031. The best way to utilize a 1031 exchange is, first, have a qualified intermediary. And second, don't touch any of the cash. Don't touch any of the proceeds from the sale of your, what we call the property given up, the relinquished property.
And I'm going to make this. It's real estate only. There are no 1031 exchanges for anything. So the best way to utilize a 1031 exchange is to sell real estate and buy real estate. You cannot use it for anything else.
Yeah, that's new in 2018. It used to be, if you traded in a car from a business, it was a 1031 exchange.
Yep, you used to be able to do inventory and all sorts of fun stuff. Now
it's all gone.
So what it really comes down to is you sell real estate and buy real estate. And this could actually go in reverse order. You could actually call it a reverse exchange where you buy real estate and then sell it. But it has to be of greater than or equal value. So if you sell $1 million of real estate, you got to buy $1 million of real estate. Even if it has debt on it, you got to replace that debt, or you got to come to the table with some cash.
Correct.
But what happens is the basis of the previous properties roll into the new property or properties. And you could sell 20 properties and buy one. You could sell one property and buy 20. It doesn't matter, as long as it's real estate. You could buy land. You could go and buy apartment building, single families, combination, commercial, residential. It doesn't matter, as long as it's real estate. So hey, somebody says, if I were to attend a two-day real estate educational networking event where I have to fly to the event, how many hours count? So like she says it's going to take 48 hours to get there and back and do it. Are they able to take every hour, or are they taking 8 hours a day?
I would think it would just be their travel and education time. I don't think you could count all those hours.
Yep. It's just going to be your actual hours. So if your actual time spent traveling, because the IRS doesn't get to tell you, you have to go the fastest route. So you can actually take a cruise ship to go to an event if you want to, as long as it's travel. There's actually rules on that. It's twice the federal per diem. That's the maximum amount per day. So like if federal maximum per diem rounds is $400, then you could write off $800 a day taking a cruise ship to go to a meeting. Not having a meeting, cruise ship, and going to a place to go, you know, you have to use it as transportation.
So Joshua asks, I thought we can take the boot, meaning the cash, out of the 1031 exchange. You can always take the boot, but you have to remember that every dollar of boot taken creates a dollar of taxable gain.
Yep. So you have to pay tax.
Up to your total gain on the sale.
Yep.
Yeah, you just have to be willing. You have to know that ahead of time, that if you take cash out of this deal, it's probably going to cost you some tax.
Yep. Or you just wait. So you do your deal, you buy something, and then you're going to refi it somewhere down the road. Then they don't really look at any of that stuff. I suppose that they could always try to argue that somehow that was taxable. But
I think they've been pretty successful at taking doing the loan after mm-hmm. the sale.
You know, most of the facilitators I work with, it's always like pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. Give yourself some time.
Yeah.
Give yourself some time and then take it out. They're not in the habit of doing that. If you're taking the money at closing, they're going to, then they will have an issue with it. And your facilitator is probably going to be looking at it going, hey, it's taxable.
Yeah. From what I've seen, they recommend that you do not refinance before you sell. You refinance after you purchase your replacement property.
Yep. And someone says, how do you use a Delaware statutory trust to avoid the timelines? You're not using it to avoid the timelines. You're using it to meet the timeline. So you're buying. So if you sell and you have 180 days to go close. So you have 45 days to identify replacement property, and then you have to close within 180 days. And you're worried about making that because you're in commercial or something. You just sold and there's no way I'm going to be able to identify and close. You use a Delaware statutory trust and it meets the test. And then you're going to do another 1031 exchange from the Delaware statutory trust to the new property. So if you're really worried about the timeline, then do a reverse exchange where you use a facilitator to acquire the property that you're going to sell and go into. And again, you still have 180 days, so you've still got to get that thing done in 6 months.
Now, I know somebody's going to ask, how long do you have to hold a property before you do another 1031? We've researched this, and the courts are all over the place on this question.
It's an investment property.
Yeah, we've seen it from a week or days to they've disqualified them years after they purchased the second property. So it gets a little crazy. There is absolutely nothing that tells us what the real answer is.
It's kind of weird. I would think that as long as it's investment property, you can do multiple exchanges into investment property. I've never seen it. I've actually seen it where we did a shopping center that went into multiple ticks, and then they ended up selling multiple ticks to get to the properties that they actually wanted to acquire. They were parking it for a while. And those lawyers all looked and said, hey, there's no hard and fast timeline. They all said 6 months is the keep yourself from getting in trouble. But
that's pretty much what I've seen is that's recommended. So
here's the thing. If you're going to do a 1031 exchange, get a good intermediary. If you need a good intermediary, ask me. I have a couple that I could send over your way that are good. They're all over the place, by the way. Like, I rarely use somebody that's in your neck of the woods. It's probably going to be somebody that I think is good. And Shauna Romero is one that I use out of Idaho, 1031 exchange gal. All I know is that whenever I ask her a question, she tries to answer it the best she can, and she doesn't play games. And I've never had an issue. My clients have never had an issue. And she's out there, and I don't even know where she's at. I just know that she's good. So there's other people that use 1031 exchanges. Find someone that has worked with folks and no nonsense. Get it done.
Right. A good intermediary is going to keep you out of trouble.
Right. Somebody says, what about a real estate that you purchase to fix and flip and you sell the property to the buyer? No, that cannot be 1031 exchanged. That is dealer property. Yeah, you get taxed on the income. The reason, Kathy, is that there's two types of income. There's investment income and there's ordinary income from development and dealer activities. And when you buy to sell, you're a car lot. You're not an investor. You're buying cars to put on your car lot to sell. That's what you're doing. Can income from self-employment be offset by the Tesla tax benefit? Tesla tax benefit, I'm assuming, is the energy tax credit, which is not a deduction. It's a tax credit.
Yeah, it's down to $3,750, I believe.
Yep. And yeah, any income can be offset with the tax credit. And the way it works is when you do your return, you say, this is how much tax I owed. And they're going to pretend that you paid them $3,750.
Yep.
So it's literally dollar for dollar. So I'm not going to beat up on that one. There's some great things, by the way. I'm doing this during a TaxWise is next one, where I broke down the solar tax credits. And you know, you can, I won't get into a whole bit of it, but you can get this, the tax credit for 30%, plus you can still depreciate 85% of that puppy. So you're getting like double duo. So if you have rental properties, it's time to stick some solar on them. Anyway, let's keep going. Don't listen to me babbling, because I'm just thinking of how cool that stuff is. Anytime I get jazzed about something, then I'll just keep injecting it into everything. I'm currently a W-2 employee as well as a real estate investor. Right now, my properties are on Schedule E. How does the tax return and tax rate change once I become a full-time real estate investor? Do you want to play with this one, or do you want me to hit it?
Well, I'm assuming that we're talking about becoming a real estate professional that we talked about earlier.
I don't know. I think they're just saying let's just say it's a real estate investor. Hey, now I decide to become a full-time real estate investor. There's literally no change.
So. I was just going to say, I'm going to say there's no change there.
Okay. Now let's say they become a real estate professional and they spend all their time doing real estate and they qualify as a real estate professional. Are there any special things that you have to do?
Yes, real estate professionals don't have to mess with the passive loss rules, which means that if I have losses in my real estate rental activities, I get to deduct them on my 1040.
And is that coming off your Schedule E?
That is coming off my Schedule E.
And is there a special box you have to check for aggregation, or is there a special form?
There is an election that you make, and you need to make it every single year.
Where do you make that election? Is that like something that's on your...
It's a statement that gets added to the return saying I'm electing to aggregate all my properties. I believe you actually list out what the properties are. And you say these activities are being combined into one activity.
Yep. If you don't do that, you're going to be very sadly disappointed. All right. Fantastic. We just got through a whole bunch of questions. I'm going to go back to a few of your live questions. We've been answering a lot of them, but I know there's a couple that snuck through. Hey, I'm doing a TaxWise June 13th and 14th. If you want to come live, you can always talk to your reps, figure out how to get there. Go to AndersonAdvisors.com, shoot us an email, give you the instructions how to get there. If you don't want to physically attend, but you want the information, that we've been doing this year, it's the AndersonAdvisors.com 3-for-1 special. So you can actually see the little link there. For $197, you get the recordings on all three TaxWise workshops this year. Plus, you can attend any of them via live stream live if you want. You're not physically in the office, but you're able to chat with the people that are and watch it live. And so if you want to virtually be in Vegas on June 13th and 14th and have a fun time, you can absolutely do that. It's I made it just a monstrous value. And I'm telling you that if you just take one or two things that we teach away every time you do a TaxWise, people say, why should I do TaxWise twice, three times, four times? Because the laws are always changing. We're always going over different topics. All I want is for someone to take two or three things away every time they attend and build up their repertoire. It's actually pretty cool. So I'm not going to say a ton on that. I do like free stuff, and I would like it if you guys were to subscribe to our podcast and give us some comments too. We work hard on these things, but you're going to see that Clint and I and Michael and a bunch of others are always working on these, where we're going and we're trying to bring relevant content to you guys. And again, it's free. You can go to Google Play or iTunes and just go to the Anderson Business Advisors podcast. And feel free to always give us, rather be in Vegas away from this rain. Christine, I am in Cleveland, Ohio, getting like, it is literally shaking the hotel windows right now. There's so much thunder and rain hitting it, and it's pelting. I don't know if you guys can hear it. I was like, whoa, is there a truck hitting this building or something? It was like rocking here. So Jeff is in the land of sunshine right now. Is it beautiful there in Vegas, or is it going to rain?
It's another cool day. It's partly cloudy. Really weird May weather here.
Cloudy with a chance of meatballs. Hey, fun one. If you want to join Infinity, I've been throwing this out there. We've had several hundred of you guys join in and go through the Infinity Investing Workshop. I'm going to give you guys a free code. It's 11 part series. Plus there's even three more. I forgot about there's a three part bonus series. And you can go there with a little link and just type in the code free tax. It's going to say it's like $1,000, but then you use free tax and it's free. Quite literally, probably 8 or 9 hours. And now some of you guys are seasoned professionals. You're going to say, I don't need this stuff. Have your kids watch it. Just have somebody get in and understand the concept of what reaching infinity. It means that you have enough passive income coming into where it covers all your expenses. And so when somebody says what their net worth is and they say, I'm worth $1 million, I always say, yeah, you know, at a fire sale, that might be 700. And if you really need it to get to the cash, how long is that going to last? I'd much rather have something that's paying me $10,000 a month. And if I could live on eight, you know, then I could live forever. I'm never going to run out. So you can hop in there. Somebody says the Anderson Business Advisor app doesn't show up on iTunes. Patty will get you hooked up, Sam. And of course, I already threw this out at you to join a YouTube channel and Facebook. Just keep up to date. Now, if you have questions that you want to get answered, there was a lot that I wasn't able to get to this time, guys. Literally, like I know this morning that they were adding in a whole bunch more questions. I know that next Tax Tuesday is going to be a rocket ship. I would just put it into Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. What we do is we kick those off to the accountants too, so that if you have questions, we're going to make sure that we get them answered. And then you can always visit Anderson Advisors again, and we have a ton of content that's on our site, including a lot of videos. Unless there's anything else, I know that there was a couple questions that I didn't get to at the very beginning. Let me answer those real quick before we jump off. Jeff, is there anything else you want to throw out there, or are you good?
No, I saw a question from Bill and Joan. Toby, why would I use loans versus equity contributions in my C corp? And the main reason for that is once it's an equity contribution, the only way to get the money back out is a taxable event. Whereas if it's a loan, you just repay yourself tax free.
Mm-hmm. Either way, like a lot of times you're taking, I mean, that's always the question you guys get, right? It's
right.
Do I want to call it equity? I mean, it's 6.5.
Well, and that goes back to the 1244 section, that 1244 allows you to convert shareholder loans into common stock of your corporation.
Okay, here we go. How soon after creating a LLC S Corp do you have to do meeting minutes? Thomas, it's really once a year. Like that's a state requirement. That's not a federal requirement. They just want books and records. How much total deduction before you can take off additional tax deduction for giving furniture and other things to charity? Is that what it sounds like? You're going to have to exceed your $12,000 if you're single, or $24,000 your Schedule A. And your Schedule A is inclusive of your medical deductions, your real estate taxes, your state income taxes, with the limitation that they're capped at $10,000, plus your charitable deduction and your mortgage interest deduction. You start adding all those things up, and then you're able to write off if it exceeds that amount. So for a lot of you guys, probably realized this last year that you didn't get to take much of a charitable donation. And that was the big fear of charities, is that people that were tax motivated to give were not going to be giving as much, just because they may not get a benefit. Somebody says, hey, they love Tax Tuesday. Great. So much awesome information, which is also cool. I have a C Corp with multiple disregarded LLCs. Bookkeeping had me set up each entity in QuickBooks as a separate company. So they have each as a separate file, which is kind of odd, really. If I have disregarded LLCs and one taxpayer, I'm probably calling them classes. But let's just say my question is, if I pay someone to do odd maintenance, such as cutting grass, painting, debris removal, and pay him from more than one entity, do I 1099 from each entity, or is it the C Corp? Example, I paid him $500 for each, for LLC 1 and 2, and I did not send 1099s because each one of those was below $600.
So technically, it's by whoever actually paid it.
Yeah, so you can get away from it. I'm just wondering whether, if it's truly disregarded, which it sounds like what they're doing is they have a corporation that's the manager.
Yeah.
I would just pay them through the corporation and just keep it real simple and give them a 1099 at the end of the year.
Right. I agree with that. You could pay them through the disregarded LLC, but that might be making it more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah. Somebody says, if I am self-employed as a realtor and if I sell three homes making $60,000 commission and flip two homes netting another $80,000, would it be better tax-wise doing it in my own name with the Schedule C or with a C Corp or an S Corp? And I can just tell you right now, Deanna, it's going to be better for you to be an S Corp compared to doing all that in your name. You have $140,000 of income, assuming that's what you're netting out. That's all going to be subject to self-employment tax. If you were simply an S Corp, and let's say we made $140,000, you could pay yourself roughly, let's just say $40,000, and the additional $100,000 would not be subject to self-employment tax. That would save you roughly $10,000 a year. And I know that sounds like a big number. It's probably more than that. But that's literally what the situation is. Like when you're making about $140,000 and you pay yourself $40,000, you're actually going to get a big benefit as a result. There's some other reasons why we use the S versus the C in this situation. Is if you're living off it, I want to make sure you still get the 199A deduction, which is a 20% deduction. Realtors do qualify, by the way. Originally, the IRS came out with guidance saying that they didn't, but they the regs have since said, yes, you do. So you can actually get a nice chunk there. Plus, you could always add a 401k on this thing and even reduce your taxes lower if you want to. And I always say that's a big if. Sometimes you have to figure out what your goal is, but you could absolutely positively increase a large chunk of money to your bottom line just by making an S election. That could be an LLC tax as an S or a traditional S. Jeff, everything else I'm looking at, I see a lot of questions. Are all distributions taxable? Somebody asks. No. If a distribution implies being taken out of a partnership or an S Corp, and that's taxable whether or not you distribute it or not. And a distribution of contributions. So there you go. So if you're giving back, let's say you have a capital account or basis, and you're giving yourself back money, then that is not taxable. All right. Is there anything else you want to hit up on, Jeff, or are we good?
No, I think we're good.
See, Jeff loves it when we go really long. And so this went flying by, and I apologize, Jeff. Anyway, so if you're good, I'm good. And we'll just say next 2 weeks, we'll meet back here. Same bat time, same bat channel, right?
Thanks, Toby.
All right.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.